Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the show, Movie Geeks United. We're on the air tonight. We got a great one. Actor Barry Bostwick is with us.
That's
awesome.
Which
is very exciting. Yes.
That is awesome.
As well as writer-producer Ryan Levin and director Jack Perez. They're all going to be talking about their great new movie called Some Guy Who Kills People. Honestly, like one of the best independent films I've seen in a while. And Mr. Bostwick's performance is the most effective comedic performance I've seen in a long time as well. So
all right, sounds good.
Definitely worth checking out. We'll tell you all about that in a little bit. Let's bring on Dean. Dino.
I love that title, by the way. What a great title that is. Some guy
it
who
is.
Kills people.
Yeah, yeah.
You couldn't ask
could be
for
about,
a direct title. I mean,
be about any one of us.
Yeah.
True.
So what's up, guys? Hey, let me ask you this: Have any of you guys ever been to one of the audience participation screenings of Rocky Horror?
No.
Oh
never.
Yeah, I have. I mean, I'm really good friends with some of the people who have done a pretty famous one, probably amongst the in the whole nation. One of the most famous troops of Rocky Horror enthusiasts around, and they're called Lips Down on Dixie, and they perform every Friday and Saturday night at the Plaza Theater at 12.
Wait a minute. What did you say it was called?
It's called Lips Down on Dixie.
And who is Dixie?
Well, Dixie is the South, and the lips are the lips that you see at the beginning of the movie, and it's
okay.
Called.
Well, that makes
and
sense.
They,
that makes
and
a
they,
lot. That makes perfect sense.
They've been doing this. They're probably one of the most famous troops that are doing it, and they've been doing it for probably. They've been performing at the Plaza Theater for at least. It might be going on 10 years now. And I actually the one of the people who started it was a guy named Aaron Siegel, who continually, I think he still plays the Charles Gray part. He plays the Charles Gray part every weekend. And he was my co-host on the show that on the public access show that I first started on. It was my first thing that I ever did on television, and we did live movie reviews every Tuesday night for about.
I'm getting such a more detailed explanation
than I thought I'd get with my
question.
I've been to this. I've been to it many times.
That's a good answer.
The kind of thing where I've just gone in and just looked at it for 5 minutes and then walked out. But Lips Down on Dixie is one of the great.
Oh my! Here we go. Play the music.
Play the music. Can you play the music?
What, the Dean theme?
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, I had Aaron actually conduct an interview for me a couple weeks ago, and he was looking on my switchboard, and he said, "Why does Dean have his own theme and I don't?" And he got a little jealous, Dean.
Oh, yeah, great. You're getting Aaron pissed off. That's wonderful.
Yeah. All right,
wow.
Dean. Here, this one's for you. Here you go. Your theme.
Ha, 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 ha,
All right. Yeah, yeah. Ooh, that's almost as frightening as lips over Dixie or whatever you're saying.
Lips down on Dixie.
Down on Dixie.
Down on Dixie. Yeah, that's even better. All right. So welcome, everybody, to tonight's show. What an intro.
I mean, really, you can't get much better than that. I mean,
let's start tonight with a little listener email. It's the best I can do as far as theme music.
I love it.
This is our new listener email theme.
Wow.
All right. Let me turn this down a little bit.
Okay. Sorry.
All right. If you want this theme, just stick your microphone up to Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, really. I mean,
producer and director Nick Everhart writes us, and he says, "I dig your show. You guys have some great content and interviews." And he sent us a link to a new 5-minute horror short that he made called Pop Goes the Evil. And I watched it. It's really good. It's really well done. So I'm going to post that link up on our Facebook and Twitter pages at Movie Geeks United so everybody can check it out. But,
oh, cool.
The website is popgoestheevil.com. So thank you for that, Nick. And then we received an email from Finland.
Cool.
I don't have any Finland theme music, but he says, "Hello, I really loved your talk about tracking shots and young movie experts. The last show we did, we had some kind of bogus list from this anonymous website listing the 10 greatest tracking shots in movie history, and they're all kind of post-1990-something. There was no sense of history in the list." And so that got us talking about, you know, the youth and if how much they or how little they appreciate film history. So that's what this listener is commenting on. "I was a little surprised that you did not comment on the definition of a tracking shot. In Norway, a tracking shot means a shot made with a dolly on tracks, and most of the shots you talked about were different traveling shots like Steadicam, crane, combination shots, that sort of thing." That's an interesting...
That's a good point. I mean, I thought about that even... I thought about even that even... after we talked about it, you know, and the definition of a tracking shot has changed because the technology has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's usually all kind of now. It's usually kind of all part of one.
Right.
You do tracking shot is just the phrase that you use to refer to all of those combinations of shots. But quite literally, you're right. It is a dolly on tracks. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we really need to define a tracking shot as being one continuous shot. I think that it's a generalized term now for being one continuous shot. It doesn't. I mean, the old dolly tracking thing is the old way of doing what we now do with Steadicam and with even things like Skycams and things like that. So.
Oh, I just recognized something. He signed off on the email. He said, "I love you." That's been a running joke for us.
I like that.
Well, here's what else he has to say. There's a movie made in Norway called A Year Along the Abandoned Road. It's a 12-minute tracking shot, in which a year passes by. And
wow.
70 millimeter. He says that he thinks that deserves a place in the great all-time great tracking shots alongside Paths of Glory. Absolutely, Paths of Glory.
Right, yeah.
And Godard's Weekend.
We mentioned that.
And the accident scene in Godard's Weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. I can't believe we forgot that. I mean, that's an amazing role.
I'm
going to
go slit my wrist now.
Yeah.
Then he
that's
said,
the last
film
I bought on VHS. Weekend.
Weekend?
Yeah.
Wow.
Beautiful movie.
Yeah.
Do you watch? When do you choose to watch that? On a weekday, just to be like.
Well, I don't have a VHS player right now, so. Yeah.
I think I'm gonna watch Godard's
what?
Weekend on a Wednesday.
You don't have a VHS player anymore.
Well, I have a built-in one with a DVD, but I don't have it plugged in. But I don't
those
even watch
cool.
that many DVDs, so I mean.
You know what? I find it difficult sometimes when, I don't know, I get in these modes where I don't want to stick in a DVD. I want to channel surf and see if there's
yeah,
something
interesting.
Yeah,
I've been
know?
Doing that or watching stuff on demand, I mean, to be very honest.
Yeah, the on-demand's great. He also says, and forgive me, Finn Frode, I think is his name, I think. He says, by the way, I took my family to see Hugo on Sunday and can happily report that my 8-year-old daughter on the way home asked if she could see some of Méliès' movies. And so it got them excited about revisiting.
That's nice.
That's great. I mean,
so he says, so maybe there is hope for some of the kids under 25.
That's good. That's good. That's one of the good things of that. That's one of the great things that movie did.
So thank
oh,
you very much.
Oh, you admit
much.
Something that you do if the movie does something right.
I don't
want
to get into
that. Wow.
I always said that that's one of the best things that the movie does.
Okay. So if any other listeners out there want to send us correspondence, we've been getting a lot of it lately. We've been reading them the past several shows.
Mm-hmm.
Send it to us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. If you want to join us on Facebook, we're on Facebook at Movie Geeks United and Twitter at Movie Geeks Unite. You can also send us messages and correspondence through those channels as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let me go through some of the upcoming content for the show. It's been like the floodgates have opened and and the guests have just started kind of pouring in.
Wow,
actually.
Nice.
that kind of happens occasionally. It's hard to keep up, though.
Right.
So, I don't know. I don't know when I finally decided to air a lot of these things. So let me review.
right. No,
this is for me as much as for anyone else. Sunday, we have Morgan Spurlock. Morgan Spurlock has a new film about Comic-Con, about the whole phenomenon of Comic-Con. Well, that's a clever phrase, phenomenon of Comic-Con. That's fun.
The wrath of phenomenon of Comic-Con.
And he'll be on the show to discuss it. It's actually, I think it's the best documentary he's made since Supersize Me. I mean, I think it's good. So he'll be on to talk about that. We'll also play the second part of our interview with Mark W. Travis, who's written a new book called The Film Director's Bag of Tricks.
Mm-hmm.
Tuesday, we just booked this. And I've been waiting to speak to this gentleman for a long, long time. Legendary screenwriter Robert Town will be joining us. This will premiere on Wednesday night, a week from tonight, on the occasion of Chinatown coming out on Blu-ray on April 3rd. God, what a movie!
Wow,
and,
what a coup that is! I mean, what an amazing legendary talent. I mean, there's not many screenwriters that you can name that are as great as he is.
And the films that he's played a role in, even the ones that he's not credited for.
I know. I mean,
the Brando Pacino scene in The Godfather.
Right.
The, you know, Bonnie and Clyde. He did work on and modern blockbusters as well. I mean, stuff like the Firm and Mission Impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And then
I'm looking at this is not from memory, but. I'm looking at IMDb right now and just look at Heaven Can Wait, uncredited. Misery
yeah.
Breaks, uncredited. The Parallax View, New Centurions, Drive.
Right.
Stage.
Yeah, no, I mean, all
the
stuff he's directed, I think, is pretty good, too. I mean,
Tequila Sunrise, Greystoke.
Personal Best.
He wrote,
Personal Best,
yeah.
Without Limits, and Ask the Dust. I mean,
Frantic.
Yeah.
He worked on Frantic,
yeah.
Uncredited, too.
He's close with
Lansky.
The Last Detail and Shampoo, of course,
yeah.
are his other two really famous
yeah.
Achievements
yeah.
from the 70s. Great.
He's
and also on that show on Wednesday night, we'll be speaking with directors Benjamin and Christopher Wagner. I talked to them today, and it's just like a super feel-goody interview, actually. They're talking about their new documentary called Mr. Rogers and Me, which is a portrait of, you know, obviously Mr. Rogers. And I think it's something that's absolutely needed, especially now when his whole message of deep and simple kind of needs to resonate a lot stronger now. It's a beautiful documentary.
Right.
And they're coming on to talk about it. Actually, they were neighbors. They were actually neighbors.
Wow. So they were actually neighbors to the premier neighbor guy.
Yeah.
Wow.
And what's actually interesting, too, is they both work in media, and I believe I believe Benjamin is the senior vice president of MTV, which is known as something completely antithetical to what Mr. Rogers represented.
Right.
So it's great that he's coming on.
And Mr. Rogers had such an Fred Rogers had such an incredible, interesting life that you have no idea. I mean, like, the average person has no idea of what kind of life he led before he was even on television.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was he always, let me ask you this, was he always, he was a priest, right? He was, wasn't he, or trained?
I know he was a trained educator.
I don't know about him being a priest, but I know that he was a war veteran that,
right, yeah.
garnered a lot of a lot of medals and so forth for his war efforts.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What day am I looking at here? April 1st, April Fool's Day. That's Sunday, right? Mm-hmm. A week from something. We'll be talking about the new documentary Corman's World, about the life and legacy of Roger Corman, with the producer of that film, Stone Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll also welcome on director David Brooks, who has a new film coming out on April 6th, and it's already available on demand, called ATM. It's a horror film.
Oh, yeah, that is on it. That is, yeah,
ATM,
And then Wednesday the 4th. Man, let me go through all this. Joe Eisenberg will join us. This has been a long time in the making. He's written a book on the making of Carrie. It's about as exhaustive as you can get. And what makes this particularly special, beyond the fact that it's concerning to Paul,
we're in it.
We're in it. Yeah. Multiple times we're sourced, so we need to sell lots of books. So that'll be our goal on Wednesday the 4th when we bring on Joe. And he's a major fan of the show, and it's interesting talking to somebody that knows everything we talk about and discuss. And he says, you know, I disagree with you about this thing that you said, you know, years ago on the show.
Yeah,
he keeps on with it. And then we're going to have our Music on Film series later on in the month of April, and, of course, our Full Metal Jacket, Episode 6 of the Kubrick series. You know what? Speaking of Music on Film, that is a great segue into Barry Bostwick's interview, because one of the movies we're celebrating during the Music on Film series is Grease. And Mr. Bostwick started in musical theater, and he was the original Danny in the first Broadway stage production of Grease.
Wow,
that's awesome.
On Broadway?
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. I mean, there have been a lot of people who played that role, too, like Treat Williams, I think, was one of the Dannys.
And that was a treat.
Yeah. So that's fascinating.
Yeah.
We're the only people in the chat room.
That's all right.
Okay. Don't you just love that? We're like the only people in the chat
room. I guess people are listening elsewhere.
Yeah, you better
be listening. It's a little private conversation between us.
It's just an intimate...
No, we got plenty of people out there listening. They're just logged into the chat room. Barry Bostwick, his new film is called Some Guy Who Kills People. He's perhaps best known for Rocky Horror Picture Show, Spin City, where he hundreds of episodes of Spin City. He did the popular television series. He's just so exceptional at comedy. An independent film is giving him a lot of chances to kind of stretch and do work that he otherwise hasn't had an opportunity to do.
Right.
We'll tell you a little bit more about the movies. Actually, it's very funny. It's a horror comedy about a man who may or may not be a serial killer. Mr. Bostwick plays the sheriff that's investigating the killing spree.
Right.
And so without further ado, let's bring on Mr. Bostwick. Here he is talking about his career and his experiences on this particular film.
Cool.
Where'd you go last night?
I had things to do. I had to meet a friend.
This thing has no head, honey.
I know, sir.
Most body have head.
Absolutely.
Where's this thing's head?
Not sure yet, sir.
Oh, we could find this head.
Good idea, sir.
Get your cat home.
A little busy right now, huh?
Somebody did old Wade in good.
Decapitado.
That hospital turned you into a zombie, kid. Right? You had no business even being there.
Our guy knew his victim. Knew him and hated him.
It's hard to imagine what those guys did to him. But whatever it was, it stuck.
I wanted to kill them, Sheriff. I wanted to kill them more than anything.
Bob ahead, sir.
Bring it on over.
It's like his eyes follow you.
So tell me about how this came to you and what appealed to you about it, some guy who kills people.
What appealed to me is that it's different, is that it sort of is a genre-bending kind of film, is that it has a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It's constantly surprising you, I think. And the part that they wanted me to play was a more rural character than I usually get the chance to play, but still with the same kind of intelligent distraction that I love to play, this sort of, you know, marching to its own drummer stuff, and I liked the relationship with Karen Black. I liked the fact that he's just pretty much a hound, you know, and takes life pretty easy and thinks he's got it all under control and it's all going along nicely, and then all of a sudden these murders start happening and he sort of kicks into another gear, yet still in the same sort of interesting rhythm. Character rhythm, which I liked about him. I don't know whose idea was that, or whether it just came out of the dialogue, or whether it was the nature of the piece that it had a certain rhythm.
Yeah.
I liked the love. I liked the family story in it, mixed with the thriller part of it, and. I just thought, and I thought it was, and I liked Jack. I like Ryan a lot. I think he's a very talented writer, and he and I had a good time, you know, coming up with little tweaks here and there.
Mm-hmm. Do you find it exciting to work with newer filmmakers in the independent form? Does it give you a chance to kind of work out some different acting muscles in a way?
Well, yeah, I think you hit it on the nose. I mean, this weekend and next weekend, I'm doing a web series with a guy named Adam Hall, who just graduated from USC. And I'm playing this sort of crazy, wacky scientist, creepy guy. And I haven't ever had that opportunity to play that creepy a guy. And he's a very talented, and he's surrounded himself with not all just, well, a lot of recent graduates and people who are just have that kind of energy, that kind of like, you know, I can just beat up the world and make it. And I like being around that. It's like having young friends.
Yeah, but that's what I was curious about, because you put your trust in a new director, new filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
What are the characteristics you're looking for to be able to invest that amount of trust in?
I think somebody who seems professional, that it's not going to be a piece of crap at the end of the day, somebody who is intelligent, and somebody who's has a sort of obscure sense of humor and sort of a look on the world which parallels mine, mm-hmm. and offers me the opportunity to, as you know, the old cliche is to stretch, you know, and it's the worst thing is actors who do these independent features and end up playing characters that they're totally wrong for, and it sort of throws the balance of the show of the movie off. But I haven't done that yet. I haven't like insisted that I play something that's so different from me. Actually, I'm actually having the opportunity to play much more who I really am in these kinds of movies, as opposed to, you know, the jilted husband or something on television, or the mean lawyer or whatever. You know, you really get boxed into those things on television, but mm-hmm. here I get to be who I really am.
Well, you've been doing it for so long, so I'm curious to know if your appreciation for the art form of acting has changed or morphed at all over the years.
I've sort of taken acting for granted. I studied, I went to college, I got a degree, and then I just sort of never went back to class. I tried to just have a life and bring that life to my work, and trust that I had enough technique and I had enough instinct to make it work. And over the years, what I think you learn to do is just relax, be less
self-conscious about, you know.
Yeah, self-conscious about your work and all your choices. And you just you just show up and do it, and surprise yourself every time you go in and do something. Whether or not my attitude about acting has changed, I think that I'm, the older I've gotten, the more I've done, the more minutia I try to explore in the parts. I'm not that attracted to stage musicals or anything anymore, because they're just a little too superficial and glamorous and out in one and look at me and all that, and they don't really offer you the opportunity to find other layers and use other parts of you. It was all very good for me in the beginning, because that's the only part I was willing to let show, was that look at me thing. And now I think I have so much more to offer, because I've lived a life, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But, whenever I talk to actors that have been in the business for a while, they say something very similar. They say, when I was young, I kind of felt the urge to throw in everything but the kitchen sink. But as you get older and more experienced, you learn to simplify.
Well, yeah, I still throw in the kitchen sink. But that's why I need strong directors, and directors who, have a good eye, because I don't stop creating just because I walk onto the set and I've learned my lines. Mm-hmm. I mean, I will constantly be looking for things and ways to do things and props and this and that, and I need a strong director to go, why don't you go back and do it the way you did it in the second take, or when we rehearsed it, or when you auditioned, or whatever. But I have to go through that process of trying so many different things, because that's just the way I work. I work by elimination. My performance ends up, I end up eliminating 9/10 of the crap that I bring to the set.
Well, you play comedy so beautifully, and you've done a lot of comedy, and like I said, you're just hysterical in this film. Is it difficult to find a tone where it's not too broad, not too underplayed.
Yeah, that's always a problem. I auditioned for something the other day, and I went in, and there was two guys in the office, and first thing out of my mouth was, how big is the comedy in this? And they said, oh, this is a very real comedy. You know, it's a one-camera show. It's all very based in reality. And you sort of have to know as you approach the work, or like in that instance, as you approach the audition, what level of, you know, wackiness do you expel? I mean, you have to, it's just a whole different sort of art form, you know. One of them becomes like clowning, and the other really makes you look so much deeper into the flaws of the character, and therein lies the humor. You know, if you're self-consciously trying to be funny, even as a human being, it's never that funny. My wife always says to me, you know, you're funnier when you just don't, when you're just yourself, you know, you don't, when you're not trying to be funny. And it,
right.
And that's sort of my goal.
Well, and I've only seen the trailer for FDR, American Badass.
Oh, well, now that's a whole different
that's,
genre.
That's broader, right?
Much broader, yeah. But you know, it's Batman-ishy, you know, Batman, and it. I mean, it's got that sort of pop fizz kind of thing. But still, you have to believe the characters, and again, it's just a rhythm thing. It's like music. I mean, there's a tempo to that kind of show, and you have to respect the writer creator's vision of it, and really listen to them because it's so specific. You know, it's a little bit like Rocky Horror. I mean, it's a very specific type of genre. It's and that's why a lot of them don't work, because unless you get actors who are willing to make the same movie together, it just becomes too scattered, and the director has to have a strong vision. And I think that in FDR, American Badass, they had a very strong vision, the creators of that, and hired really good actors who had the ability to underplay, you know. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, by underplaying it, we're overplaying it. We're, you know, the comedy is in the underplaying. The comedy is in the sincerity by which we you know, play the scenes.
When the werewolf attacked you, in vitriol, like,
shit goblins!
You released a small stream of... You've got the polio, Frank. Does my cock still work?
How in the world are we going to storm the beaches of Normandy, take down an entire army of werewolves, and still make it to a French titty bar by last call?
I present Douglas MacArthur, Chief of Staff of the United States Army.
Dougie Mac.
This is Commander Winston Churchill.
This is General Dwight Eisenhower.
Mussolini.
Hitler. Eleanor Roosevelt.
Albert Einstein, the real jackass.
Shut the fuck up, Einstein!
Play it a play, pimp to pimp, I appreciate it.
I'm a motorcycle of death. I ain't got no sidecar.
Damn you, Frank!
We have nothing to fear but
Marco
Polio.
Fear itself.
You know, as actors, you really have to trust your material. You just have to trust that the story is working in your favor, and that the rhythm of the scenes is working in your favor. And you don't. This is what I learned doing Spin City a lot, is that you don't have to always feel like you have to put a hook on something or find a different way to do it or add something to it, like you're talking about the kitchen sink. You really just have to trust the material, and I think as you age and do more and more work, you're hopefully attracted to material, and you have the opportunity to do things that... you can trust and just let the words speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm. You know, you did. You started in musical theater, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's so many great actors out there today, but less and less have a theater background. Do you think that that's essential kind of training for film acting?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, I found that I had a lot of bad habits I had to get over to be able to work on film, things that I had learned for the stage and things that benefited me, you know, on stage, size of performance and a certain energy and and so when I was sort of transitioning to movies and television, I had to go through a real adjustment period of all of that. I don't know. I think if they're well trained actors are well trained at any age for the medium that they really want to focus on. I think stage teaches you discipline. I think it teaches you the ability to rehearse and repeat performances, which I think are real important. Because as you know, when you're shooting movies and television, you're shooting all out of sequence, and you have to have a sense of the whole. And I think by working on a play or a musical on stage, you have that. You have an innate sense of the whole because you're playing a whole thing every night in your beginning, middle, and end, and you're trying to organize it in your brain and in your mind and in your energy. And I think a lot of people who work on film and haven't worked on stage in some ways don't see the big picture.
Mm-hmm. Well, because in film, it just by the nature of the process, it's more about the minutia, working on moment by moment,
yeah,
as opposed to the whole arc, which is, yeah.
Yeah, but as you're saying, but you still need, and I think that's the value of theater, is you discover an arc and you play on the arc and you change the arc, and every night the arc in some way when you're on stage will adjust itself to the evening and to your moods and to the rest of the actors and this and that, but you develop this instinct for it, and I mean the best film actors started on stage, all the way Brando,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, before I let you go, I wanted to ask, of course, about Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Sure.
You've been asked everything there possibly can be asked about the movie, I'm sure, but this came really early in your feature film career. What is it like to be a part of a cultural phenomenon that occurred that early in your career?
Well, I think just because I made it early doesn't mean it became a cultural phenomenon
right.
early.
right.
That's the difference, you know. I mean, when it first came out in 76 or 75 or something, I was basically working on the stage. I was, you know, I had a pretty good career on Broadway going at the moment and at that time. And I didn't even remember it opening. I was so involved in other things, and it wasn't until 8 years, 7 years, 6 years later did it sort of ring a bell that thing it was having some legs, and it was becoming a sort of an interesting theatrical phenomenon. And only in the last 10 years, maybe, have I really thought about it and had to think about it, because people ask me questions about it, about, you know, why did it become what it became, how is it affecting people, how did it affect me, you know, it was just another job at the time. I mean, it wasn't anything life-shaking for me, other than the fact that we shot it in England and I'd never been abroad, and so it was... there were some interesting life lessons I had in it, but it sort of went along with what I was doing on stage. Some of these sort of larger-than-life, funnier... I'd been doing some rock musicals in New York, and I'd been doing a lot of theater, and there was obviously a very theatrical side to that film that I responded to and I liked, and which was challenging. It's like I was saying earlier, you know, the size of performances, it was challenging in that because everybody had to have that sort of hyper reality. It was such a strange world we were living in, you know.
Yeah.
Rocky Horror, and I was playing the sort of straight guy, the anchor, Susan and I were the anchors in that, and so we had to be particularly careful and not camp it up, you know.
Right.
Because everybody else was camping it up around us, and they wouldn't have been effective if we were all just camping it up and not thinking about the real moment to moments in the story. But how did it affect me? It still affects me. I love that movie.
But, you know, it goes to show that you never know what will hit the zeitgeist. It's not something that you can ever plan.
Right, yeah. And people who have tried to make another Rocky Horror kind of experience, they always failed because it didn't have... They try to do it, and that movie was found by the folks and the people, and they created an event out of it, and you can't make people fall in love with something as full and as rich as that. Nobody's been able to reproduce it. And because I think partially because there's a certain innocence to it, yet a sort of dirtiness, but an innocent dirtiness. You know, it's like it has such a wide appeal, and parents bring their kids to it now. I don't know. I think if you watch that movie without all the stuff that goes on the stage and all of the hoopla and the, you know, the rice and the toast and all that, which is all fine and fun, but I think if you really looked at the movie, you'd see what an interesting, well-crafted movie it was.
Yeah.
Tight. All the performances were spot on. Good music. I think it deserves a place in film history that it, and not just because of everybody making it into something, this event that it is, but I think the film itself is unique and way sort of ahead of its time.
Yeah. I do too. Well, Mr. Boswick, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Well, thanks. You've provoked me in interesting ways.
Well, good. I'm always happy to provoke. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
I'll
you
see you
too.
Later.
Bye-bye. All righty. That's Barry Bostwick. His new movie is Some Guy Who Kills People. He's playing in festivals across the country and internationally. You can find more information about the film at someguywhokillspeople.com. Very, very Bostwick. Dean, you got to turn off your radio, Dean. You like the interview, Jerry? I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was really good. Really, really good. Because, I mean, that's a good interview just because that's something, I think I speak for a lot of people, a lot of that we didn't know. I mean, we know, like, you know, Watchmen, Spin City, or TV, or something, or movies, but for a lot of that, we wouldn't know. So that's a really good interview.
I love talking acting with, you know, actors. And something occurred to me, Barry Bostwick. What a great actor name.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you gotta be an actor with a name like Barry Bostwick.
It's got that
George Washington
thing in it.
Yeah.
George Washington, a TV movie. I remember when we were, like, in junior high, I think, or something, you know? That was
well,
good.
check out that trailer to, we played a little bit of it, but that trailer to FDR, American Badass.
Yeah.
he looks so funny as FDR. Yeah, that's great stuff. A little bit later on the show, we'll bring on the film's writer, producer, and director, Ryan Levin and Jack Perez. We'll close the show with that.
Oh, cool.
Okay, Dean, the few minutes, tell us about an upcoming festival that you're going to cover for the show.
Well, I just got approved to go to the Atlanta Film Festival. Of course, I live here in Atlanta, so it was a natural thing for me to apply for press credentials for the Atlanta Film Festival. The Atlanta Film Festival is really interesting. You wouldn't expect this, but it's really one of the oldest film festivals in America. It's now in its fourth decade. It started in, I think, 71. I think its opening night movie when it first started was Deliverance.
Wow.
And
that's setting a stage right there.
Yeah, it is.
Was the festival originally called Lips Down on Dixie?
Oh my God.
No, I mean, it's always been called the Atlanta Film Festival. For a little while, it was controlled by the Image Film Collective that's here in Atlanta, and now it's gone back to the Image Film Festival, but now it's gone back to the Atlanta Film Festival.
Okay.
So
what are you particularly anxious for with the festival, to watching and covering?
Well, I mean, the opening night movie is a film that I don't really know a lot about called Life Happens, and it's about New York scenesters approaching middle life and approaching having families and so forth and so on. That is the opening night movie, and I've seen other opening night movies. A few years ago, I went to American Splendor, which was one of the opening night movies for the film festival that year. But so the fact that they chose it as the opening night film, means a lot to me, so I'm kind of looking forward to that. The closing night movie is Joss Whedon's much talked about The Cabin in the Woods. So I'm excited for that as well. But I'm also excited for a few other movies. There's the movie VHS, which is much talked about horror film about a group of thieves that are burglarizing a house, and they get a VHS tape, and a lot of it's shot on actual VHS. So it's got a kind of gritty kind of feel, and it's actually sort
just
of
like
a,
Jerry's Godard Weekend.
Yeah.
It's like a Tales from the Crypt or whatever.
It's a horror anthology. It's got seven.
It's an anthology
directors.
Movie. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's got a host of different directors, including Joe Swanberg, who's famous in the sort of mumblecore thing for doing.
Yeah, I was just
like
thinking about him the other day. All right.
Ty West does one. Ty West.
And also
one of the directors of The Signal a few years ago, another horror
That's
film.
That's a crazy movie. I remember seeing that in the theater. Oh my God.
Yeah, so that looks interesting. Also, Robert Townsend's new movie. Robert Townsend has a new movie called In the Hive.
What's it about? Do you know what it's about?
Well, I have a little thing here. I can't put it into a 16-year-old extra keys lives by a few simple rules, all rooted in a world of brazen, retaliatory violence. His survival depends on his ability to be brick-hard, emotionless, and impenetrable to everyone. Only his infant son is excluded from the hard-shell persona. And it's kind of like this character trying to shield his son from his own misdoings in the past.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Man, I saw one movie that he did years ago with Ving Rhames. I think it was about Sonny Liston. It was
I vaguely remember that.
Not good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, he's, you know, I mean, it's a long way from Hollywood Shuffle a few years ago, you know, in the late 80s. But still, it's interesting to see.
It sounds
very
different from him. It sounds like a very different kind of film.
Yeah, well, it'll be fascinating.
That's what I like about what you've summed up so far. Let me ask you this: is Whit Stillman's Damsels in Distress going to be there, or?
I wish. I mean, you know, no, unfortunately.
I think you know, with Damsels in Distress, I think that's actually already going to have a theatrical release.
Yeah,
that's
April 6th. I know in
New
York.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Did you guys read the thing in the New York Times Magazine this Sunday? There's a big story about him. That was fascinating. I had no idea that he was that much older than us. I had no idea.
Yeah. He's a couple of decades.
No, but he has a very
keen... Yeah.
He's a very keen ear and eye for, you know, for you know, young person's dialogue and everything. He got so many... I mean, I'm very curious to see how this film plays out, because those are three really good movies, especially Barcelona. That's my favorite of the three.
And it's very fascinating too that he's been so long since his last movie,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he has been doing you know, television directing, you know, and so forth,
right?
Occasionally, but. Another film that I'm looking forward to, even though I'm not really into this director, is Bobcat Goldthwait's God Bless America.
Yeah, I want you, that's one of the two movies that I want you to see at this festival. I want you to see God Bless America,
mm-hmm.
Because we're going to bring on Bobcat Goldthwait for that. And then I want you to see Compliance.
Compliance is on my list as well. Also, there's a documentary called Beauty is Embarrassing about Wayne White, who started his career.
I don't need to know about a documentary about my life.
No. It's about Wayne White, who started his career as a cartoonist in New York City and later on went on to be a designer and actor on Pee Wee's Playhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, he became kind of a celebrated pop artist. There's a couple of Georgia, one documentary that I'm very interested in that we should have this guy on the director on the show is Mike Malloy, who's written for, you know, Shock Cinema and so forth.
Right.
You know, if you guys know Shock Cinema, he's written for that. And he's done a documentary called Eurocrime, the Italian cop and gangster films that ruled the 70s. And he talks
we should
a
have
lot.
Him on. Yeah, you're right.
He's got a lot of interviews with a lot of people who were involved with the Italian cinema of the 70s. And then also, unfortunately, they're programmed right next to each other, so I'll have to get a DVD with one of these. But also there's the one that I'm most excited about is a movie called Basically Frightened, which is about Colonel Bruce Hampton, who is a famous jam band godfather of the jam band scene. Who was, you know, part of, I mean, the guy played alongside Led Zeppelin in the late 60s at the first Atlanta music festival here in Piedmont Park. But he has gone on, I mean, he was in Sling Blade aside Billy Bob Thornton. Billy Bob Thornton is actually in the movie, and he talks about you know, Colonel Bruce's effect on the music industry. It's one of those things that if you don't know who Colonel Bruce is, this will be like a revelation, because I mean, there's people from REM like Mike Mills and Peter Buck that are interviewed in it, and people from Fish and so forth and so on. So it's like Derek Trucks is in it, and it sounds. I've seen like a, you know, it's interesting. I've seen like a very early cut. My my relationship with this movie is old, because I saw a very early cut long time ago, and it's been, this thing has been percolating for like a few years now, so it's finally out there. So basically, Frightened should be very interesting. Also, Barbara Birmingham, which was nominated for the Oscar this year, will be playing as part of a shorts program, and there's a lot of good stuff. I mean, we'll be talking about it later.
So when
on.
Is it? When does it take place?
It starts on the 23rd and it ends on the 1st, and you can go to AtlantaFilmFestival.com to see the lineup. It's a pretty interesting lineup, and you know, if you're in the area, I recommend coming to it.
Well, I'm thinking of covering the Sarasota Film Festival this year too. That's mid April, and they announced their stuff too. They're opening up with Robot and Frank. Frank Langella is going
to
be there.
Oh yeah, that's supposed to be pretty good.
Their centerpiece movie is the new Todd Solondz movie. He's going to be there. And then
what's that called? Do you know what that's called?
You would ask.
I'm sorry. I know of it. I don't know the title though. I just don't.
I'll get that. And then okay. Darling Companion, the new Larry Kasdan movie, will be there. And
that looks good. I think that looks good.
Is that the closing night or?
No, that's not the closing night. I'll have to check and see what the closing night is. I got to look up two things now. Hang on.
Well, I didn't know. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to put you to work. I mean,
no, that's all right, man. The new Todd Solondz movie is called Dark Horse.
Oh, okay.
And I'll find out what their closing night movie is. So, but you know, it's been a couple of years since I've attended.
Right.
So that'll be good.
Well, you've done a lot of good for them on this show. I mean, you've really, I never heard of it before we did this show, so I think you've done a lot of good for them.
Oh, it's one of the great interactive festivals.
No, it sounds that way, and I mean, it definitely sounds that way.
Right, in Sarasota, and the nice, really nice area Sarasota is, and it's ideal. But anyway, we have our list of the night. You want to go through our list of the night?
Let's do it. It's got to be better than the last one. Please, God, let it be better than the last one.
Now,
is it Stephen King one?
No. Stephen King and Tracking Shots. Those were our last two.
No, the Tracking Shots is interesting. The Stephen King how many Children of the Corn sequels can you have? I mean,
all six of the Children of the Corn movies was on.
Well,
that
who knows?
List.
Children
That's
of the Corn might actually make it into this list.
Oh God! Oh dear God! What have we done?
Anyway, Dean, I know you sent me a list. We'll do that next show because I'd already reserved one list for tonight.
Okay.
Total Film ran down the 200 greatest movie performances of all time, and we're going to go through the top 20.
Oh,
okay.
God, I thought you were going to say 200, man. We'll be here till next week. I got a lot of work to do at work, man. I can't just be sitting here.
All right, so will Children of the Corn make the list? I don't know.
If it doesn't, I'm writing them a nasty letter. That's all
yeah.
I'm saying.
Number 20 in the greatest movie performances of all time, they give to Bette Davis in All About Eve.
Okay, I'm not going to argue with that.
Well,
I mean,
okay, so far so good. All right,
nice.
All right. Number 19, they give to Peter O'Toole in Lawrence of Arabia.
That deserves to be there. I'm not.
There
right now, I'm just really curious to see what. God, now you're going to make me go look this list up later.
Another great classic male performance at number 18, Hilary Swank in Boys Don't Cry.
I would leave that lower.
I would put it lower, but it definitely deserves to be on there.
It's a mesmerizing
performance. I mean,
it's good, but I would put it lower.
Number 17, Sylvester Stallone as Rocky.
No,
I don't know. I'm not saying I don't know about. It is a great. The first one.
I mean, I love that movie. I love that movie more than most people do. I mean,
right.
Most people like throw that movie off to as it's like it's chum or something, you know.
Yeah,
but
I think he gives a performance, and there's a scene in there with Mickey that this is the one time. I mean, I like Stallone. He's great, and I like him more as I've gotten older. I went through a phase where I thought a lot of stuff he did was junk, but he gives that speech he gives to Mickey. When he says, "I never had a prime, you did, everyone, I never had it." is such a moving, emotional
scene. That's his I Could Have Been a Contender.
Yeah, and that's a great, great, great scene.
And his scenes with Talia Shire are amazing, too.
Yeah,
so,
first one, we forget, before he fights the Russian, before he fights her, the first one has so much heart and everything.
It does, and it's gritty, too.
It is gritty.
I think he's great. I think he, because he wrote it too, he created one of the great classic characters.
He is a great character. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, he definitely belongs on the list. I mean, we can argue back and forth about it.
Yeah, let's go.
Number 16, they put Jodie Foster in The Accused.
It's a daring performance, and if you think about what she had to go through to like film the rape scene in that movie, which is a great scene.
Scene and everything. But aren't you disturbed right now? Two of the female performances are rape victims.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. It's just an observation.
No, that's a fair observation.
Yeah, it is.
Number 15, Tom Cruise in Magnolia.
Why not the whole cast of Magnolia?
It's weird because then we're getting into supporting performances. It gets a little weird, Like, are we gonna put supporting performances up there with lead performances? It gets really strange.
No, I don't think you do. I mean, I think if you fully embody a part and you make it kind of
an iconic
part, it doesn't matter the size.
It's a fantastic performance, no question about it. Really, in that movie, Philip Seymour Hoffman is just as great in that movie. So, it's okay, go on.
Number 14, Jimmy Stewart in Vertigo.
I'm not going to argue with that at all.
Number 13.
Oh, God.
My Cocaine.
which?
My Cocaine.
My Cocaine. And Get Carter.
Nah.
I don't know. I wouldn't put it so hard. I mean, it's a great movie and everything. I don't know if that's... you're going to put that ahead of Lawrence?
Well, would you put it ahead of any of My Cocaine's other performances?
I don't know. I like Zulu an awful lot. I like The Man Who Would Be King an awful lot too.
I'm a big fan of Sleuth.
Sleuth. I mean, the original.
Yeah.
Okay. Just making sure.
No Death Trap.
Death Trap 2, as a matter of fact.
I love Get Carter, don't get me wrong, but there are other pieces, we forget, even though he is the very definition of a working actor, there are a lot of other great roles there.
Number 12, absolutely, this would absolutely be on my list. This would probably be in my top five. Gene Hackman in The Conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
For
definitely.
Sure. No question about it.
Number 11, Meryl Streep in Sophie's Choice.
I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting. Number 10, Liam Neeson in Schindler's List.
I love him in that, and that might make it onto the top 200, but.
Not
not that high.
He said, this writer says, given the emotive subject material, it requires a firm hand to keep things from slipping into melodrama, but it's a task that Neeson shoulders manfully, providing the film with its moral core without any missteps into unqualified sainthood.
Well, I think that there are missteps in that movie, and they appear in the movie's last 20 minutes.
Number 9, Paul Newman in The Hustler.
Yeah.
Well, knowing that they're not going to put two Paul Newman performances in the top 10, Paul Newman's greatest performance is in The Verdict, I think.
I think so too. I think so too. I love the verdict. Number 8, Jane Fonda in Clute.
Another good, very good performance, you know, but I wouldn't put it that high.
It might be probably one of my favorite Jane Fonda performances, but I definitely wouldn't put it that high. I mean,
I was having a conversation about Jane Fonda the other day with during an interview about,
maybe
you know,
Monster in Law, but no.
Number 7, Denzel Washington and Malcolm X.
It's a great performance.
I don't know if I'd
put it that high up there.
It's a great role, but it's, I've never been a huge Denzel Washington fan because I don't like those actors that I feel are picking from. I'm not a big fan of those actors that I feel are picking from a bag of tricks that they have that they're using over and over again. And, I mean, it's a great role, but I don't necessarily think it's the greatest, one of the top 10 performances of all time.
It's good. I like their other Washington performances that I like just as much. Like, He Got Game or American Gangster, or even I liked him in Safe House or something. But I think my thing with Malcolm X, I haven't seen Malcolm X since it came out, so I'd have to go back and watch it.
I've been so wanting to get the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
It's actually, I mean, I love Spike Lee, and it's a movie I really like. And I don't know how that part can be played any better.
I don't either.
He was the right guy for the role at that time. The problem with that is that I don't think that that's such a – I think that that's a movie that gets better in its second hour, but in its first hour, it's not so strong.
Yeah. Well, whenever I think of Malcolm X, I always think about the brouhaha that Pacino won his first Oscar and beat out Denzel. Because that's the year he won for Sin of a Woman, and everybody was like, really, you're not going to give it to Denzel? You're going to give it to Pacino for that movie?
Right.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Pacino won?
Well,
Pacino had been making movies for 30 years without, 25 years without a win, so it's all right.
Yeah, remember Washington did get a supporting for Glory, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Number 6, no argument here, Marlon Brando, On the Waterfront. If any performance changed the history of American performance, that was it.
I would agree, although I personally would pick his performance in Streetcar Named Desire, but the only difference is that he had performed Streetcar Named Desire on stage many times before, and so.
Emily Watson in Breaking the Waves at number 5.
Wow, that's amazing. That is my favorite performance, my favorite film performance of all time.
Really?
But I don't know if I put it that high up. And I love Emily Watson, but I don't know if I put it that high up. But it's a great, great performance.
I think it's the greatest performance that's ever been put on film.
Even better than your own performances, Dean?
Yes.
Okay.
Performance in the one movie that I was in, yes.
Okay, all right.
I give a performance.
It's an incredible role, and she deserved to be nominated and everything. I mean, wow.
I gave a performance in a Roddy McDowall film about killer monkeys where I was a college student who was late for class on a pink bicycle, and I think that I deserve some kind of...
I put it number 1 on this list, so...
Have I already told you guys that I was actually in a movie that does have a cult following?
No, I didn't know. What movie is this?
I was in a movie that was... this was in 79, and I was...
Edward Petasant?
No, this was in 79, and I was standing on the side of the road, and a casting director came up to me and said, do you want to be in the movie? And, of course, I was a movie fan. So, anyway, I was in a film called The Sheriff and the Satellite Kid that had, and it was kind of like an E.T. movie, but it was before E.T., you know, it was like about an alien that comes down and befriend somebody, and he has to protect them from the authorities that are coming to take him away. the satellite kid was played by Terry Guffey, who was in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He was a kid in Close Encounters. And the sheriff was played by what's his name? The guy that was in all those Italian movies. I can't even remember his name.
Master Antonio.
if you'll bear with me for a second here.
What did you do?
Yeah, what was your part?
I was. It was just a little part, and I was playing. Well, I was a fat kid at the time, just like I am a fat adult now.
Fat adult. I like that Jason Reitman film.
I was playing a kid that was part of a fat family that was looking at the landing of the alien, and it happened here. They filmed it here in Stone Mountain, and the actor in it was in a lot of Terrence Hill movies. I'm about to get to it right now. Hold on a second. cut this out.
Jeez.
But yeah, I know.
All right, let's play some Dean looking at the internet for research music.
Bud Spencer.
Okay.
Bud Spencer.
Bud Spencer. Sorry. I'm sure glad we solved that mystery.
Yeah, well, Bud Spencer is actually, if we were talking to Michael Lloyd, he would know.
I can't
exactly
stop this music.
Okay, so now we have to wait for the music to stop.
I can't find the file for this reason.
Oh my God.
Hey guys. All right, here we go. Okay. Oh man.
So anyway, it was Bud Spencer, who was in a lot of Terrence Hill movies like My Name is Nobody and stuff like that. So
cool.
Yeah.
All right. You guys remember the list that we're talking about the top 20 greatest performers? Okay. Now we're up to number four. And this is definitely in my top five as well. So I'm in agreement about this particular performance. It's Al Pacino in
of
The
course.
Godfather Part Two.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, oh,
yeah.
God, yes. I mean.
See, I think The Godfather Part Two and Dog Day Afternoon are his two greatest performances.
I think Dog Day Afternoon is his best performance. I just watched Dog Day Afternoon the other day, and I just cannot believe how great he is in that movie. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have just – you can just feel how that performance just set him.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
Number three, this high up, this performance – Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood.
I have no beef with that. I would put it behind, though, Michael. Michael Corleone is just one of the all-time greatest, the greatest character in American fiction and film. I mean,
it's difficult, though. I mean, is it any more or less great than Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot? I mean, gosh.
Well, I mean, he is great in that movie, no question about it. And I remember watching that movie for the first time and not being so impressed. I was sort of irritated by the fact that he kind of stole his vocal cadence from John Huston.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, there is some of that, yeah, without a doubt.
And they were, of course, screening Treasure
especially when
Madre
he refers to,
quite about
to especially when he refers to Paul Dano as Mr. Getz. I think that was just too far.
But I mean, of course, they were screening Treasure of Sierra Madre quite a bit during the filming of that movie,
mm-hmm.
And so you have to feel like he might have taken some kind of some influence from that.
Right. As all actors do. Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that's a difficult role to play. I mean, that is a difficult role to play. To play a role in which someone has no connection to anyone whatsoever, that really doesn't have any love for anybody.
And it's so different from the movie he was in before that, The Ballad of Jack and Rose. I mean, it's such a wildly different. And that's just about all of the parts he plays. You can never say he's playing. I know that there are people that say that there's something between that and Bill the Butcher and Gangs of New York, but not really. I mean, every part that he plays is really wildly different.
It's very distinctive, and you can tell he lives inside of it.
Oh, yeah.
When you compare that performance to Age of Innocence, for instance.
Yeah.
You can't believe it's the same guy.
Oh, I have a very hard time with that. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah, that's a meaty role.
I mean, in a good way.
That's a meaty role. And number two is a role that required an actor to become meaty, which is Robert De Niro in Raging Bull.
Right.
Of course.
I don't know, man.
All right, well, number one. What's number one? Just tell us what number one.
It's definitely Robert De Niro's greatest moment.
I don't think it was. You know, I'm in the minority that I think Raging Bull is an overrated movie.
Really?
And I think his work in Taxi Driver is far superior to Raging Bull.
I think Taxi Driver, and I think he also does a great job as the young Vito Corleone. I mean,
I'm with them.
I'm going with Raging Bull.
Number one, the movie and the performance that made me fall in love with movies and performances. It's Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Okay, I'm not gonna.
I don't have any problem with that.
Yeah, I mean.
I might not put it at number one, but that's splitting hairs.
I mean,
it's like it would be in the top five for sure.
What other Nicholson performances are on that list besides that one?
I'm sure there are lots.
Oh, okay.
They're 200 pages. There's not like a list.
Okay, no, we're not doing that. No.
It's interesting, though, because I love him in that movie, and obviously I love the movie.
Right.
Kind of changed my life in a way, but it's never been on my top five in terms of performances, and that's probably very unfair of me. And Nicholson even said this, that his biggest obstacle with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was the fact that people thought that he was perfect for it, that he could kind of do it in his sleep. And he said that kind of discounts all the immense work that I put into that movie to get it right. Yeah.
I never felt that, you know, I mean, he might have been perfect for it, but I never felt that it was a role that he didn't have to work at. I mean, I feel like I feel about Al Pacino and Dog Day Afternoon, which actually came in the same year, which was it was a role that you could feel it absolutely took everything out of him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, took everything.
And what a piece. I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, both it's very kind of delicate. You know, is he dangerous? Is he fun loving? Does he have just a wild streak? What you know, is he a Jesus figure? You know, there's lots of traps that you can fall into.
Yeah, is he a criminal? Is he not a criminal? You know, even the characters that are with him. I mean, there's even that great scene where he plays opposite the guy who's the caretaker of the entire hospital, who was a non-actor, by the way. And that scene.
Well, are you talking about the opening scene?
Yeah, the opening scene where he's like
amazing.
Giving the interview and everything.
Some of the best acting I've ever seen. And you could tell that that was so off the cuff. Like Nicholson was saying, they were probably saying, Nicholson, just do some surprising things. Try to surprise. And the guy was. And the doctor, who was really the doctor there, he was just incredible. I actually wrote that doctor because we did a Cuckoo's Nest show years ago. And I wrote to him, and he's retired in Washington. He's still living, as far as I know, or he was a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that doctor is great in that scene, too.
Absolutely,
I mean,
great.
His only scene in that movie, and it's really a strong scene, you know.
There's another scene that he's in, actually. And it's odd because I don't know if this was a deleted scene and they put it back in to fill the time when it aired on TV. But the first time I watched the movie was on TV. And I'm sure because of ratings and that kind of stuff, they did that with Halloween. They filmed a lot of extra footage that they just put in the TV version to fill the time for all the stuff they cut out. But there's a scene where he's sitting around with the other doctors, and they're talking about whether or not to keep McMurphy in the hospital.
No, that's in the original. I saw it in the theater when I was a kid. That's in the original movie. So, yes, he is in two scenes. And he's also in the scene where they discover Billy Bibbit.
So you know, it's an incredible, and he's actually, I mean, he was the one that accommodated that production at that real hospital amongst those real patients. He was the kind of the saving grace of that hospital. And that movie is so gorgeous and graceful because just the experience of being in that real life place among all, and that they're all living there.
Yeah,
it infuses that movie. Oh.
You can feel the ghost walking around in that hospital. That is not a set. You know.
That is the most transcendental kind of movie I've ever seen. It's an amazing movie for me. And a few years ago, there was an article there, shut down the hospital, and it was just in terrible shape. They had, like, tissue samples and all this kind of stuff of patients from decades earlier that were unlabeled and remains of patients that were not. It was just a terrible sanitary disaster, that place.
Is that Dean R. Brooks as Dr. Spivey? Dean R. Brooks, right.
Yeah.
He's so great in that movie. I mean, like, it's just like a great little supporting performance by a non-actor. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And I'd written the film commission in Oregon around there to try to find anyone that was related to the production, I remember. And that's how they... I've actually got the email here. Gosh, I haven't seen it in forever. January 14th, 2008. Dean is retired, did not renew his license in 2004. He pretty much is keeping a low profile since he is 91 years old.
Mm.
Last I heard, he was living out his days at his home in Washington.
Mm.
So you may want to contact him there. And then they gave me his information.
By the way, okay, so if you guys had one performance that was not mentioned in that top 20, forget about the other 180 performances. You know, they might have mentioned it in those 180. But if there was one performance that you want to be in that top 20, what would it be?
Robert.
I mean,
Hang on. Jerry just gave us an answer.
Yeah, Robert Mitchum out of the past I would put in there.
Hmm. That's a good one. I would put in another non-actor performance. I would put in Dexter Gordon in Round Midnight.
That's a really good one.
Well, I already revealed mine, which is Pacino in Dog Day.
Okay.
That's one of my all-time favorites.
Like, you would put in all the Pacino performances all in the top 20. It'd be nothing but Pacino in the top 20.
No, that is so not true. And Pacino's only in a couple of my favorite movies, and the performances follow suit. And the only two Pacino performances that would be in my top 20 would be those two. It would be Godfather 2 and Dog Day Afternoon.
Well,
I think
so.
I think he's overrated in Serpico. I think, you know, there are a couple of performances of his that I obviously find downright weak. So I'm not like a blind Pacino loyalist. He's just the most passionate, interesting actor alive for me.
Well, I mean, you see what I'm saying, though, when we're looking at that top 20 and everything. You see what I'm saying with the one odd man out there is Tom Cruise in Magnolia because it's a supporting performance. And,
right.
And it's very difficult to measure a supporting performance against a lead performance.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it seems unfair, you know. So it's like, I mean, the Magnolia is not about Tom Cruise. So it's like, in fact, there's no lead performance in Magnolia. So it's like, I don't know. It just seems weird to have him in the top 20.
See, I mean, and I think supporting performance can be just as great as lead performances.
True. Okay, so name a supporting performance that you would put in the top 20.
You would ask that, and now I can't think of I'll think about that. I'll think about that, and I'll come back with an answer the next show. But,
okay.
You know, I also think about great movies for performances. I mean, that come from the most unlikely places. I mean, one of the best kind of unlikely movie that contains two just powerhouse performances for me goes back to two actors that were on this top 20 list. Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington. I think Crimson Tide is a great actor's piece. I mean, that feels like a real, like, mano-a-mano movie in a completely unexpected way. And I think they're beautiful together.
Well, I mean, that movie is a remake, kind of a lot of movies that were made in the wartime thing, you know, like in the wartime realm, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, you know, there were a couple of movies that were made about two battling guys, even on submarines, you know, that were battling each other for the control of the submarine. So
right.
That movie's kind of an homage to those movies. And I don't feel that movie is really that much different from those movies.
Well, I absolutely do, because the high point of that movie and what makes it special and different is Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington going at it together.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes that movie pop. Without them, the movie wouldn't pop at all for me.
It's not a movie I like.
Okay, let me see. Let's get to our final interview.
All right.
And we'll close the show with this. We'll be back Sunday. Morgan Spurlock will be with us, director of Super Size Me and the new documentary on Comic-Con.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, guys.
No, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
I enjoyed
it. Fun.
We're going to close off tonight with the writer, producer, and the director of Some Guy Who Kills People, Ryan Levin and Jack Perez. They're going to talk about the process of putting the movie together, casting Barry Bostwick, and the challenges associated with independent film. We'll see you guys on Sunday night.
All right. Good night, everyone.
See you on Sunday.
Get away from me!
Do you have any aspirin? I have a splitting headache.
I always carry aspirin, so you don't need to axe.
Well, this was no accident.
Well, this guy's going to heaven, and he's got an all-access pass. The axe.
What are you doing?
I thought we were doing puns.
Oh, why would we be doing puns?
I felt like you were doing puns.
This guy's got a hatchet in his head, and then he was dumped in his backyard after his birthday party. No, our guy knew his victim. Knew him and hated him.
Why would someone douse a body in gasoline and not burn it?
So we'd find it.
Tell me, first of all, Ryan, this project, the seeds of it actually kind of started from a short film you did, right?
Yeah, I did a short film called The Fifth, which I shot in the middle of 2006. Just very last-minute project. It was a script that I had written just for fun without any intention of really making it. I was on a TV show as a writer assistant at the time and showed it to some people there, and they all were kind of jazzed about making it, and they basically just helped me shoot it over the course of a weekend, so I basically had like a professional TV crew helping me make my first short, which I had no plans to even shoot in the first place. And before I knew it, I was quote unquote directing my directing the film. And then many months later, we finished it, editing it and such.
And then I took it out on the festival circuit and had a great time with it. And but I there was something about it that I wanted to continue, and a seed of an idea that I wanted to explore further, which is what I started to do in the early drafts of Some Guy Who Kills People, basically just having this sort of John Doe everyday type guy character, protagonist, who's got his life, got his job, got his friends, and has on the side is basically a serial killer. And that was sort of the general premise that I took out of the short, and then it kind of morphed into its own thing, and now bears very, very little, if any, resemblance to the short film.
Well, but, you know, your script has, I mean, it's actually, it's very suspenseful. You honestly don't know what the outcome will be. It's kind of unexpected, and also very comical. And those are two kind of competing emotions a lot of times. It's hard to do both of those well within the same film.
Yeah, the only ever worked in comedy. It's really where my interests lie, but my inclinations always to go, and my interests are always sort of on the darker side of comedy. So the intention with the film was always, I mean, just given the premise of it, of a serial killer, but I wanted to make it a comedy, but I didn't want it to make, I didn't want to make it serial mom.
Right.
I wanted it to be darkly comedic. And I also have a love for horror, even though I have never written horror, but just because he's a serial killer, I knew that there would be elements of that. So I guess ultimately what I wanted was to make it funny. First, I never considered it a horror film. I never considered writing it as a horror film. I always considered it writing it as a dark horror comedy. And then throughout the process, some of the horror aspects of it kind of got scaled back as I started to implement some other storylines. But yeah, balancing the genres was definitely, in writing it, balancing the genres was always a big challenge, and then getting notes from people. And along the way, sometimes I would kind of go too far in one direction, and it was sort of too goofball-y and slapsticky, and then I'd take it back, and sometimes I'd go the other way, and it was just kind of too somber and depressing. And so I sort of had to strike the balance as best I could, and on paper. And then obviously that's something that, you know, Jack and I talked about pretty much from the beginning, was how best to convey that mix of genres. And then once we started shooting, it was basically up to Jack and his direction and the cast to blend those genres successfully, so it didn't feel like you were watching eight different movies.
Well, and that was exactly my point. I mean, it is so exceptionally balanced, and I think both kinds of genres are very seamlessly interwoven in the piece and effective, because all the relationships you've built within the screenplay are so well defined, and you genuinely empathize with these people. So Jack, the pre-production of this film, it took kind of several curves. I know at one point John Landis was attached, and he had to go and do Burke and Hare, I think, is the film that he did. How did you come on board, and what were your first impressions when you read the script?
Well, you know, I actually didn't know that Landis was scheduled to direct the picture, and I didn't know any of that background when I first met with Ryan, having been given the script to read. So, you know, I read the script, and I look, you know, the script, you know, writing is like acting in Hollywood in that there are, everybody thinks they can do it, so there's a lot of people out there who call themselves actors and a lot of people call themselves writers, and consequently there's a lot of, you know, bad stuff floating around. So I guess I've become cynical because I didn't have any expectations when I read it, but when I did, I connected with it immediately, not only because it was such a fine piece of writing, and that's rare, but also the subject matter was something that I responded to personally. And I've also liked genre that sort of subverts itself. I'm more interested mm-hmm. in people who subvert genre, like someone like Robert Altman, who, you know, play in, like, with The Long Goodbye, the detective genre, Miller. But I always appreciate, which also has a good sense of humor. I mean, Altman always has very believable characters and real drama that you can invest in, not melodrama. And then also this really offbeat humor always creeps in. Anyway, so some guy reminded me of that very much, which I love. And it reminded me more specifically about An American Werewolf in London. That's what I think I brought that up in our first meeting. I said, you know, tonally, this reminds me a lot of An American Werewolf in London, which I loved because it managed to be very serious and horrific and genuinely funny altogether, and that's rare. And they kind of looked at me, Ryan and another one of the producers sort of looked at each other like, does he know about the Landis connection, that kind of thing. So it was just an odd coincidence. And anyway, so all I knew is that they were looking for a director and that I really wanted to direct the picture. I really wanted to do it because it's just rare you get a hold of something you connect with. So fortunately, I ended up being hired, and then I found out that Landis was now our executive producer while he was going to make Burke and Hare, and eventually it was just Ryan. It was up to Ryan and me to make the picture. So, but I was really lucky to get the job.
Did you and Ryan kind of hit it off right away?
I think so. I think Ryan was sort of, when I first met Ryan, he had gone through a lot of ups and downs of production of it, almost getting made with Landis and financing falling through and all this other stuff. And I think, you know, he had had to, as we all do when you're trying to make movies, because inevitably something always falls apart and you either give up or you keep trying. So I think Ryan had gone through two of these, like, big crashes only to start again. And when I met him, he looked a little sort of, he looked a little beat up. And at first, I interpret that as, well, he's not too crazy about me, so I'm probably not going to get this. But ultimately, when I did come on, there seemed to be a very clear connection, probably because of our first meeting. That I guess I was seeing the movie as he saw it, and my job from the beginning was to maintain what was so special about the script when it got to the screen. That was the whole thing. I mean, I had no interest in changing anything, or, you know, I just wanted to serve it. So fortunately, our sensibilities, which I guess are a bit askew, perfectly match or in sync. So that was, you know, I don't think I probably would have gotten the job if that wasn't the case.
Well, you guys have such an exceptional cast that you've assembled for the movie. I mean, Kevin Corrigan,
yeah,
is great, and Karen Black, and on and on and on. But this is your opportunity to talk about Barry Bostwick. Return the favor.
Well, Barry, yeah, I mean, Ryan and I were in the room, and our casting director had actually brought him in. And actually, we didn't know he was coming in, nor did we know Karen Black was coming in, or Lucy Davis, or really any of the people that are so special in the movie. We didn't know any of these people were coming in, and they were just sort of on a list that morning. So we were both, Ryan and I were both looking at the list going, geez, wow, Karen Black's coming in, Barry Bostwick's coming in? You know, and I hadn't, you know, I hadn't really watched Spin City, but I knew Barry Bostwick from the movies, you know, and I knew him obviously from Rocky Horror and a number of movies that he had done. But I don't think either of us was prepared for his audition, which was, you know, like, he came in fully that character, even more so. I mean, he was kind of actually, like, manic, like, crawling around on the ground and stuff when he...
Yeah.
He sort of,
You know, in writing it, I mean, honestly, like, Barry never crossed my mind as a possible sheriff. specific look in mind, and a lot of the people that came in had that look, and it was very tempting to just be like, oh yeah, okay, there, you know, good actor, has the look, let's go, yeah, let's go with one of them. And then Barry Bostwick comes in, and I was just blown away by what he did, which was basically a completely different take on the character. I mean, it was rooted in what was in the script as far as, you know, being an offbeat, weird sheriff, but he took that to, like, a 12, and whereas a lot of people just took it to, like, a 4.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, like, laid it all out and was fearless. And you know, it could have been, you know, I could have, like, we could have, like, respected him for his fearlessness and been like, but, you know, have him, but he could have completely missed the mark. Instead, he was completely fearless and original and unique and also hilarious. And obviously, as the writer, you hear the lines being said a particular way, and he just completely, you know, he obviously doesn't know how I hear them in my head, but he just gave everything its own spin and gave everything a completely different take than I had it in my head, and it was far superior to what I had imagined.
Well, I would imagine that there was no rehearsal period on the script, was there?
No, there wasn't. There was, actually, that's not true. I think I had 2.5 hours with Kevin and Lucy in an audition space, and that might have been like 2 days before we shot. I mean, typically, it's ridiculous because rehearsals, you know, are should be essential, but they're never practical in any movie, no matter how big, but, you know, whatever the budget, either there's no time or like Kevin, for example, was on the Tony Scott picture. What was the name of the train picture?
Unstoppable. Yeah.
Unstoppable, yeah. So he was on Unstoppable, like, right up until, you know, he came to do our movie. So there wasn't a lot of time. Anyway, but yeah, basically we had a couple hours with Lucy Davis and Kevin just kind of going over a couple of their scenes.
Well, I tell you why I ask, because you're a lower budgeted independent film,
lowest,
which means you're on a very tight schedule, and you have all of these enormously creative and talented actors as part of your cast, and I'm sure that, like you just expressed with Barry Bostwick, they're very inventive. They want to try things. How do you balance that? How do you accommodate that?
Well, I think in the case, you know, what we did do was we did get everybody together for a table read. Which is hardly a rehearsal, but really it was an opportunity for everybody to meet everybody and just read the script together, so we all sort of knew what we were doing. And it seemed like, to me, from the very first table read, that people were approaching their individual characters with a certain, they were all like in the zone very much, in the target area. And like nobody had some, with the exception of Barry in the audition process, which we approved, nobody was going in a direction that was, you know, out of order with what Ryan had intended. So that was a lucky thing, because obviously if anybody had been like making their own movie, which happens every once in a while, I'll be watching something with my wife and we'll say, boy, that guy's in his own movie, you know, which is clear. He's like, whatever he's seeing, nobody else is seeing. So everybody was sort of on board from the beginning. And then during production, it was really a matter of acknowledging right away when we ran the scene that this is right, like this is where the scene needs to go, this is correct, you know, encouraging their choices so that they stayed on this particular track. And I think after the first couple of days, it became clear exactly what the tone was, which, to be truthful, was actually quite naturalistic, even though there are moments in the film that seem kind of broad or broad it's the situation itself that's broad. It has little to do with what the actors are doing as performers. Everybody,
right,
like in that movie, just played it straight as a serious, I don't want to say as a serious picture, but as a real thing. Like, no one was tongue-in-cheek. No one was self-aware. No one was wink-wink. Everyone was just, I'm playing this character as a believable human being. And then whatever comedy, of which there's a lot, comes out in the movie is in how Ryan has scripted it, and what the situations are in the story itself that are comedic. But if you look at the performances in and of themselves, even Karen, who has the most, you know, kind of classic, iconic, you know, the mother, you know, the mother from hell character, even she is still playing real, you know, playing it for real. So that even at the end, there's a scene, you know, where her boyfriend, the sheriff, and her are talking about Kevin's character having killed all these people, and Karen is just destroyed, you know, by this thing, and you know she's you know obviously crying and has been crying for a long period of time, and even though some of her mannerisms are comedic and the lines are funny, and Barry's doing this whole bit, Karen, they're both like really there. So that was really the tack, which is just play it straight and let the script do the comedy stuff. You know, obviously they have to understand comedy to play it.
Right.
But that was sort of the overall approach that hopefully kept everything, all the different genres glued together.
Yeah, and I would think that comedy, in order for comedy to truly resonate, it has to come from a place of truth.
I agree. Yeah, I totally agree. I think that even in Melbourne, you know, even something like, you look at something like Young Frankenstein, you know, which on the surface, that's super broad. It's still like, you believe these are real people and you care.
Mm-hmm.
You're invested.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the trick, I think. Otherwise, it's just banana peel, wacky, get hit in the balls, you know, with something,
yeah,
kicked in the balls kind of stuff, you know.
So let me ask you about the festival, the upcoming festival dates. What's coming up?
Yeah. Let's see here. We have Boston Underground Festival, which is on April 1st. We are playing, it's not a festival, we are playing at a art house theater in Phoenix called the
awesome.
the film Bar, I believe.
Yeah.
And that is, that starts March 22nd and then runs, I think, like 6 nights. Gosh, I'm totally blanking. The Calgary Underground Film Festival, which is, I think, mid-April. And then there's Dark Bridges Festival, which is in Saskatoon, Canada, which is in May.
Mm.
And then there's another one in Maine.
There's a bunch.
You guys are all over the place. And so what's the ultimate game plan once you get past the various screenings and showings and such?
Well, at this point, actually, the festivals are just a way of getting the film exposure.
Mm-hmm.
We sold the film domestically, so we just signed a deal for U.S. distribution, and then we're on the cusp of making a distribution deal in Canada, and then we sold it in the U.K. and a bunch of scattered places in Europe, Australia. But yeah, ultimately, when it comes out on DVD, VOD, Apple, iTunes, Amazon, etc., people will be aware of it. Again, it just comes down to word of mouth, and you know, the more people talking about it and telling their friends about it.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually been kind of grateful for the number of festivals we've been invited to, because you know, as distribution, theatrical distribution gets harder, you know, it becomes the place to see the movie on a big screen. You know, it's probably gotten more, played on more screens just through the festivals than it would have in a traditional, like, indie art house, you know, release. So that's been actually pretty cool. I've never really looked at it that way, but because we've been able to play so many festivals, a lot of people have gotten to see it projected, which is cool. You know, and it obviously plays fine on smaller, you know, platforms, but it's always gratifying to, you know, for people to, you know, to have people see it in a theater, you know.